feel like I know all of you personally because of Jean being my cousin and Connie, her husband, being your, I think, your tour leaders, is that right, during this time? And they were out here last year with a group of people also during the time that Judy and I were in the village. So it's been fun to have you around and eat together and have breakfast and hope you have a very good journey. I understand you're going to go through Rapid City, which is where I grew up, close to the Four Faces. My 98-year-old mother and her 98-year-old twin sister still live in Rapid City. So if anybody wants to give her a call on the way home, our name is Oksol, O-K-S-O-L, O-K-S-O-L. She married a Norwegian. When my brother and I, we're Danish people, and my brother and I went to Augustana College. But earlier than that, when we were driven off the farm by the Depression in 1936, I was 9 years old. Now you know how old I am. There was no Danish church in Rapid City, so we got into the ELC, the Norwegian church, and Francis, my younger brother, and I went to Augustana College, and we double-dated for a Lutheran Student Association banquet the women that we later married, both of whom were 100% Norwegians. And my mother one time said, "I don't know why you guys got mixed up with those Norwegians." And then after my dad died in 1954, she was a widow about four years, and lo and behold, she married a So what, how's they say it? What comes around, or what goes around, comes around. So we've kidded her a little bit about that over the years. But Mom's always been a great mom. She's deteriorated a lot in the last 6 months, emotionally, mentally, her memory, and so on. But we still talk to each other. She can hardly hear, so it's very difficult. If you call her, you have to yell at her. That's the problem. And I was talking to a couple of women at breakfast about calling her, and I think we decided not to do that because I think she might worry that something's wrong. If she were to call and say, I met Verlin out at Holden Village, she'd think, oh. She's always inclined to think something's wrong. Yeah. Every time I talk with her on the phone, she says, "Are you okay, Verlin?" She always calls me Little Verlin. I'm 71 years old and I'm still her little boy. But it's a great gift to still have Mom around when you're 71. Not many people can say that. And she's a great mom. A little crazy, but she'd love that if she listens to this tape. Well, we've been talking about Luke this week, and how many of you are new this morning that have not been here so far? I do want to review, for the sake of you who have been here, to review. Teachers always do that, right? But for the new folks, to kind of bring you up to where we've been. The agenda for the week is on the board. The overall title for our week is Jesus and Jubilee. And the thing that's impressed me very, very much as I've studied Luke, spent a lot of time with Luke this summer, and this week, of course, trying to stay one day ahead of the class, is how central the Jubilee theme is to the Gospel of Luke. And that's the overall message of the week, if you will, that central to the Luke's Gospel is the Jubilee theme. And we began on Monday by doing an overview, looking at the first verses, where the writer of Luke says, "I've been looking at all of the oral traditions about the things surrounding the life of Jesus, and everything that's been written about that, and lots of people have written about it, And now I want to put down, after a very careful investigation, I want to put down an orderly account so that you might know for sure that what you've heard about Jesus is true, that you might know the factuality, the actuality of those events. And then goes on in the book of Acts to bring the story another generation after the life of Jesus. So that was what we talked about the first day. Then on Monday we looked at the key passage in Luke, which is chapter 4, the sermon that Jesus preached as a young rabbi in his home synagogue. Some of us who are pastors can remember that first time we confronted our home congregation and preached that sermon, and how the people were well pleased with what he said, but after a while they got so upset that they wanted to throw him over a cliff. Now that hasn't happened to most of us pastors. We don't get that kind of response generally. In fact, sometimes we don't get any response at all. It was kind of a tough time for young Jesus. And what he did was to quote from the 61st chapter of Isaiah, where Isaiah talks about the good news being preached to the poor, and the oppressed are going to be delivered, and the blind are going to see, and a whole new kind of reality is emerging. And then he says, today this has been fulfilled in your hearing. And then he goes on to talk about how the prophets Elijah and Elisha ministered to, would you believe, the Gentiles, the non-Jews. And then when we got to the Beatitudes on the third day, on Wednesday, we discovered that Jesus is talking about the poor as being blessed, and the hungry are the blessed ones. And we're surprised to learn that. Even now we're surprised to learn that, but in those days, those people were on the bottom of the purity code. The purity code said that the priests and the Levites and the Israelites were at the top, and the bottom were the Gentiles, and even below them were the people who were crippled and the poor, because they believed that if you're faithful to God, you will prosper. Read Psalm number 1. It's the simplest theology you can imagine. If you're righteous, you'll prosper. If you're unrighteous, you will not prosper. And the logical following of that is that the poor people are those who have been unrighteous. And Jesus turns that upside down. He turns whole society upside down. And that's what the Jubilee theme is, that the whole society is going to be profoundly changed. The Messiah has come. It's going to be a new time, a messianic order. And then he teaches us a prayer. We call it the Lord's Prayer. That we found in Luke, and we found it in Matthew. We compared those passages. We find they're a little different from each other. And as I've been thinking about this, I've been thinking that the Lord's Prayer is a Jubilee prayer. May your kingdom come. And with that, the outrageous prayer that we pray, that earth might be like heaven. That earth might be like heaven. And that the hungry would be fed. Give us this day our daily bread. Not a pile of bread. Don't give me a big bank account. I'm not asking to be rich. I want like the Israelites. Have you seen this book by Dan Erlander, who was the campus pastor at Pacific Lutheran University? They have lots of these in the bookstore. It's a beautiful book. He does his own cartoons, and he handwrites these pages. Manna and Mercy. And he picks up the manna theme, remember from the Exodus story, and how they were told not to take more than the day's supply. And everybody will have enough. But of course, there were some of those greedy capitalists, pardon me, who wanted a little extra so they could store it away in a bank account, you know? And what did it do? It rotted. Didn't work. That's the whole Jubilee theme, right there in front of us. whole theme runs through the New Testament. That's the message of Jesus. Very, very primary in the Gospel of Luke. Well, today, well, before I get to that, I'd like to call attention to something we didn't mention before, but it's really nifty when you see it. I was told the other day that when I use the word nifty, I'm dating myself. But several years ago, I got tired of everything being neat. So one day I said to myself, I got to find another word. I don't want to say neat. And the word nifty came to me. So I'm kind of offended when people say that dates me. I mean, that's a new idea.
You know, it's better
to do it as nifty.
It's better for that to date you than for you to date a Norwegian.
What's even worse is when I got interested in Judy, you know, Judy belongs to the United Church of Christ, and my mother said, couldn't you have found a girl of our faith? So I asked her, tell me, what's the difference between Judy's faith and my faith? And she didn't know. That's all right. And she likes Judy a lot. Only problem is she doesn't see her often enough. She worries about that. She'd like to see her more often. In the very first chapter of Luke, you remember what we have? If you want to look at it, it's in the Bible, the very first chapter. Look at verse 46 and following. I'm going to put on my reading specs, which I only wear when I want to see. These are my $12 drugstore glasses. I get so tired of these bifocals, where I have to go, you know, some of you are like that. I have to see through that about a half inch on there. No, I want, the doctor says all I need is magnifiers. So I have glasses that have a whole glass, like my bifocals. Mary has just visited Elizabeth, and she sings what we call this? Magnificat. Have you ever noticed how political that Magnificat is? Mm-hmm. Talks about economics. Mm-hmm. Get down to verse 52. He has brought down the powerful from their thrones and lifted up the lowly. He's filled the hungry with good things and sent the rich empty away. There's the jubilee theme. Already in chapter 1.
Not for the rich.
Pardon me?
Not for the rich.
No, no, no. But the rich think they've got it made anyhow. And that's the point, isn't it? That Jesus visits the people who are on the outcast. Did you hear that poem that was read to us?
Mm-hmm.
When was that? Matins. Beautiful. On the outcast. Beautiful, beautiful. I thought, that's the jubilee. Jesus care for the outcast. And then another place where that appears is when Simeon talks in chapter 2, verse 34. 2:34. After Jesus is born, they go to the temple, they meet Simeon and Hannah. And Simeon is talking to the child's father and mother. Isn't that interesting? Legal father. Were amazed at what was being said about him. Then Simeon said, Simeon blessed them. There's that word, the attitude word. And said to his mother Mary, this child is destined for the falling and rising of many in Israel, to be a sign that will be opposed, etc., etc. A couple of writers that I've read suggest that that's the key theme in Luke, falling and rising, falling and rising. And we see it already in the Magnificat, we see it in Simeon, and I'm suggesting we see it in this whole Jubilee thought. where Jesus is showing in a very radical way his primary concern for the people who are on the bottom of the purity code, the people who are despised in their society. Now, when we get to the parables, which is our task for today, I think we see the same thing running through these parables. The parables in front of us are those that appear only in the Gospel of Luke. Just think of it. If we did not have the Gospel of Luke, we would not have any of these parables. And most of you folks know these parables very, very well. I put up here the title that traditionally we've used, the great good Samaritan, rich fool, great priest, etc. And they all come out of that part of the Gospel of Luke that's unique to Luke, namely from 951 to 1814, where Jesus begins, according to Luke's Gospel, his journey to Jerusalem. This very determined language. He set his face to go to Jerusalem on his way to the cross. And these parables. And for those of you who remember the Jesus seminar we talked about, all of these parables are either in red or pink in the Jesus seminar. The scholars are quite convinced that these are either the actual words of Jesus, or at least they very probably are very close to what Jesus said. The only one that's not so is the rich man and Lazarus, which appears in gray and black in their book. They're not sure about that one. That may not be important to you, but I think it's kind of interesting that there's scholarly agreement that these are part of the work, part of the teachings of Jesus. Now we can, let me stop there. Any questions so far? Let's be sure that we're all together. Put on my specs so I can see you. Where they are.
Did you say that all the material in this section is only in Luke, or is it just the, so from 952
to 18 something? 14. Yeah. It's unique to Luke. It's often, scholars always point that out. This is a section you find in Luke, it's not in the Gospels. Now, look at the Good Samaritan. You all know that. Chapter 10, I'm going to turn to it. Context, the lawyer comes, he's a smart aleck lawyer, and he, you got any lawyers in the room? I have to be careful. like a good lawyer, he asks questions, and this is a trick question. and then he knows his Torah. The lawyers were the scribes, they were the PhDs, they knew the law, the Torah. Actually, the word Torah would be better translated by the word instruction rather than the word law. God's instruction. I often say that God's law is like the driver's manual you get with your new car. It's really not a law, but what it is instruction on how to best run that car. You can ignore it. I mean, you can put kerosene into the gas tank, but who gets hurt? Does the manufacturer get hurt? You're the one that gets hurt. And that's how God's law is. God's law is not God's wrath. God's law is God's love. God gives us a law out of love to instruct us as to how best we can live personally and how best we can live as a society and community. And we can flaunt that, just like we can flaunt the law of nature. I can get up on the roof here and walk across the roof. When I get to the edge, I can keep walking. And the law of gravity is going to come into play very quickly. And I'm the one that's going to be hurt. The law doesn't get hurt. We don't break the law. The law breaks us. Right? Torah. And the Hebrews understood that, that the law of God is God's love, God's expression, God's instruction to guide them. And this lawyer knows the law. That's his job. He knows the law. He's an expert in the law. And he summarizes the Torah accurately, to love God and to love your neighbor. You've all learned the Ten Commandments have God in the second half or have to do with the neighbor. He knew that very well. And then he presses, who's my neighbor? Presses the issue. Good lawyers always press the issue, right? So Jesus doesn't get in an argument with him. He never gets in arguments, really. He disarms his opponent, if that's even the right word, his adversary, by telling a story. Then you sort of got to figure out what he's saying. What he does is tickle the imagination. He kind of lifts us out of the debate so you don't get too mad at each other. And you can think a little bit about what's going on. It's a wonderful teaching method. Most of us aren't smart enough to do that. So this guy gets robbed and lying by the side of the road, and the priest comes by, the Levite comes by. Where are the priests and Levites on the purity code? Right on the top. The priests are number one, we learned the other day, on the purity code. The Levites come next. These are the pure guys. You know, these are the holy people. These are the people that go to church every Sunday. These are the people that have sung in the choir for 25 years. These are the ordained ones who went to the seminary. They come by, they walk right by. Now, why do you think they walk by? Have you ever thought about that? Why did they just walk by?
They didn't want to get involved.
Wasn't there a law on cleanliness if you touched?
Pardon me?
Wasn't there something about being unclean if they touched them? Wouldn't they become unclean if they touched them?
The suggestion is, remember he was robbed and beaten and left half dead? The suggestion is, that has been made that the priest and the Levite probably thought he was dead. And you could not touch anything dead without being desecrated, and according to the purity code, according to their theology. So you know, they don't want to do that. They don't want to ruin their status by touching this dead body, but they are afraid it might be a dead body. So the priests and Levites go on. Well, imagine now the listeners to the story, the people who first heard Jesus talk. They thought, well, maybe some of them are saying, well, yeah, that's the way priests are, you know. That's Levites, yeah. I was kind of expecting that the next person who comes along might be a good, faithful Jew, huh? But who is it that comes along?
Samaritan.
A Samaritan, for crying out loud. Who would ever guessed? The Samaritans were the kind of half-Jews who lived up in the northern part of Palestine, and they were considered to be the worst of all. They were even worse than the Gentiles. After all, the Gentiles couldn't help it. They were born that way. But the Samaritans should know better. And they were not keepers of the law from the standpoint of the Jewish people. So they were everything bad. They were on the bottom of the purity code. So who is this guy who comes along, and he's the one who shows, what's the word? Compassion. Compassion. Central word, compassion. And helps the man. You know the rest of the story. Isn't that a marvelous story? And then he turns to the lawyer and said, no, who was neighbor? Have you noticed the shift here? The shift? We shift from the neighbor as in the objective case to the neighbor in the subjective case. And the neighbor is not the person acted upon in Jesus' question now. The neighbor is the person who's acting. Who is being a neighbor is really the way he asks the question. Which one is being a neighbor? And the lawyer says, well, I guess it must be the guy who helped him. He caught on. He was smart. And that's the story. Marvelous story. Some of you know the name George Johnson. Who was it? Kenneth Knudsen. Is he here? Yeah, okay. You know George Johnson. Are you related to him? Okay. George used to be the head of the hunger program for the American Lutheran Church before the ELCA was put into being. He's a very good friend of mine. In fact, he was my student at Augustana College many years ago. I won't take credit for anything that he does, but we continue to be friends. I see him once in a while, not often enough. But George wrote a little book called Beyond Guilt and Powerlessness, which is falling apart. I don't know why Fortress Press did such a lousy job in putting this book together. Look, its pages are falling out. But he has a quotation from a person that I don't know. He's a Catholic priest. I thought I had that marked. Yeah, here it is. Father Ed De La Torre, who talks about the Good Samaritan parable. And let me just read some of this. Around the biblical parable of the Good Samaritan, with the addition of three or four commentaries, all of which are apocryphal, we understand our role not just theologically, but politically as well. It is this parable that Christians in the Philippines use to justify working within the struggle for liberation. He's a Philippine priest. In the pre-political interpretation, the story is simple. There's a victim, priest dropped by, etc., etc. The model the Christians given for loving is the Good Samaritan who helps the victim, but that is in very personal and individual terms. How does it become political? First, how does it become social? According to the first apocryphal story, the Good Samaritan came week after week. This is his rumination about it. The Good Samaritan came week after week and found victim after victim, and he said, here's a problem. It's no longer an individual problem, this is a social problem. It needs a social response. True to his good nature and his political limitation, he went around to his fellow Samaritans and collected money to set up a Good Samaritan hospital. Because there are very many victims, you need an institutional response to an increasing number of victims, right? But it's not quite political yet. It becomes political because when you put up an institution like a hospital, you have to hire a staff and you have to have staff development seminars. When you have staff development seminars, they start analyzing, why are there so many victims? According to the janitor, well, it's simple, he says. Like you ask me, why is the corridor always wet? It's because someone has failed to turn off the leaking tap. There are many victims because someone is causing those victims. Oh, the robbers. Now that's the first lesson in politics, not to see only victims, but to see the robbers. Normally the church sees victims, help victims. Sees robber and says, don't rob again. Moralizes it. The robber says, I have problems. My children need money. They are into drugs. The church can help the victim and help the robber and see that they both need help. According to the second apocryphal story, another story he makes up, one day the Good Samaritan came 1 hour earlier, and instead of seeing only the victim, he saw the robber robbing the victim. The victim was not yet the victim. He was resisting. The Good Samaritan says, I still must love, but how do you love? That is the problem. How do you love? Why do we look at ourselves as the Good Samaritans? Couldn't we be the victim? Couldn't we be the robber? Why is Christian morality associated with the Good Samaritan? Why is the Good Samaritan, what is the Good Samaritan politically? The Good Samaritan politically is in the middle, not quite robbing, not quite victim, not yet oppressor, not yet oppressed, not very rich, not very poor either. We're in the middle, where most of us want to believe that we are. Not involved, but feeling the need to get involved. Does that sound familiar? Because that is the ethical call to act. Once you see that, the call is to love. To love in a conflict situation is to take sides. Once you take sides, your next dilemma is, how far do you go? I just think that's really fascinating.
The thank you, Bob.
An interesting way of looking at it, very familiar peril. Any comments, questions about that?
One very sad commentary on the Good Samaritan parable is the fact that laws now have had to be passed to protect the Good Samaritan.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, the Good Samaritan is responsible for whatever happened to the victim and ended up in a lawsuit.
Comment, I'm sorry. It's dangerous to be a Good Samaritan.
There's certainly many situations.
Right. Well, Rich Fool, you know that one too. Chapter 12, 13, following. Again, you have Jesus, there's a context provided by Luke. Someone asks for help. Jesus questions whether it's legitimate or appropriate. Maybe he suspected a trick question again, if you think about it. The moral is life is not to be equated with the abundance of possessions. We often say, what's the man worth? The richest man in the world. Every once in a while, the newspaper lists the richest people in the world. Bill Gates is up here at the top somewhere. We have Kurt Carlson in the Twin Cities, who's supposed to be a billionaire. We have how many millionaires in Minnesota? Hundreds of them. That's the value. That's your value in terms of your bank account in our way of thinking, right? But this guy, well, John Dominic Crozon, the author that I mentioned yesterday in this little book, has a neat way of paraphrasing. That's the book is full of paraphrases. Here's his paraphrase of this parable. A rich landowner made some long-term plans. I will sow and I will reap. I will plant and I will gather. I will fill my storehouses to capacity. I will have more than I could ever want. That night he died. And then the statement, it's better to be rich toward God. Do not be anxious. That wonderful passage about the ravens and the lilies. And then in verse 31, if you're following along, strive for the kingdom of God, the kingship of God. It is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. Does that sound like Luther's small catechism we looked at? It's the Father's, it's God's good pleasure to give us the kingdom. Kingdom will be ours. God will prevail. God's rulership will prevail, ultimately. We may not think so, but sometimes it doesn't look like it. Sometimes we even despair of the possibility that God's will can prevail. The Great Feast. I'm going to move over some of these a little more rapidly. Again, I think you see immediately how this parable speaks to the Jubilee theme. When you have a feast, Jesus says, don't invite all your friends and neighbors. Go out and invite, who are they? The crippled, the lame, the blind. You know, according to the purity code, the people who were deformed physically were on the bottom of the purity code. You had to be a perfect physical specimen. You know, we used to say that at the seminary, that you couldn't be ordained unless you were a perfect physical specimen. Did you know that? I had a classmate who was blind, and he was denied ordination, even though he had a call from a congregation in Watertown, South Dakota. His name was Emil Larson, one of the most intelligent people I've ever met. I went through college and seminary with him. I was his reader. He was blinded in the Second World War when a landmine went off and he caught a face full of shrapnel. And he told me about the last light he ever saw was the light of the doctor's flashlight to see if he could see. And then it was black from then on for the rest of his life. He was denied ordination by the Evangelical Lutheran Church, the Norwegian Church, because he was blind. I had another friend who had one arm missing, missing about here.
There was one who questioned my ordination.
Because is that right? Because of your arm. Yeah. But you were ordained ultimately?
Yes.
Yeah. John, I must know his name, a classmate of mine. Not Gilquist, but he's worked for years for the St. Paul Council of Churches as a mechanical hand. And they said, maybe he would not be able to hold the communion plate. I heard that. But it's this righteousness kind of stuff. You know, you gotta be complete in order to be acceptable.
This has nothing to do with our study, but why were they allowed in the seminary if they were going to be so hypocritical as not to ordain them at the end of their studies?
A very, very excellent question. And I don't know the answer.
It's two separate groups.
I've asked that myself. I wonder that. Why Emo was allowed to go through the whole seminary, and then when he was ready to graduate, had a call. You know, call is a prerequisite to ordination. I understand. He had a call.
There is a passage in the scripture on which they based that thought. I can't remember what the passage is, but there is a passage that suggests unless you are complete.
Is that Old Testament?
Is that Old Testament? Well, in the Old Testament, in the Levitical code, if a person were a eunuch or crippled or lame or blind, that was God's curse in a sense, and so they weren't allowed to be a priest. But we go beyond the physical. Those of us who are divorced, those of us who are single, there's a tarnish, there's a blemish, and so let's not touch that person. Let's not let them be over us.
No, that's right. Some of that stuff still is with us. And Jesus says, invite those people to your banquet. That was a scandalous idea in that day. Because the whole idea of eating together was, as you well know, you've heard this thought countless times, was in the ancient world was much more than just eating together. It was accepting each other. It was a fellowship, a koinonia symbol. You only ate with the people that you wanted to be friends with. Here you just bounce in and sit at a table. That meant something to invite somebody to your home. And, you know the story. When the good people wouldn't come, they had all kinds of excuses. Then go out and invite the bad people. Go out and invite the riffraff to your banquet. The poor, the crippled, the blind, the lame. We get this combination of words all the time in Luke. And the word poor is very often associated with those other words. So it's pretty clear he's talking about something different when he uses the word poor. He's not only talking about people who don't have money, he's talking about people who are outcasts, people who are, you know, people look down their nose. Do you have any people like that in your town? They're not always very pretty. Don't expect them to necessarily respond favorably to your love and care. They might throw you away. But Jesus tells us, keep at it. Invite the poor. Most of our congregations are made out of good middle-class white people, aren't they? I know what congregation I served was. Prodigal son, we know this one. This chapter 15, of course, has three parables: the lost coin, the lost sheep, the lost coin, the lost son, as many like to call this one. Again, you got the context set for you. These Pharisees were grumbling. That's a great word, grumbling. I always liked when the Israelites left Egypt, we're told that they were murmuring. The word just sounds like what it is. You're grumbling. Sounds like what it is. The Pharisees, look what's going on here. This guy, Jesus, thinks he's a great teacher. Look what he does. He pals around with these woofta people. look at the company he keeps. What kind of a guy is this? So Jesus tells his stories about the lost sheep, the lost coin. He doesn't engage them in argument, he just tells the stories. And then you are sort of left with that. Well, this is very, very well known. One of the things I thought about in looking at this parable is, we were talking the other day about voluntary poverty, the monks who take the oath of poverty, chastity, and obedience, and they voluntarily leave their fortune behind, like Francis of Assisi did, to become poor for the sake of the gospel, and that's blessed. And the voluntary people who seek to reduce their, or to simplify their lifestyle. Mahatma Gandhi one time said, the world has plenty of resources to satisfy everybody's need, but not to satisfy everybody's greed. So simplifying our lifestyle has to do with caring for the earth, caring for the environment. My wife's concern in her work. There just simply are not resources on this planet for everybody to live like you and I live. There simply is not. There's enough food. God has answered the prayer, give us this day our daily bread. All the experts, we have a good friend who teaches at the University of Minnesota, he's an international oats expert, and all of these people say there's enough food on this planet to feed everybody. The problem is one of distribution. And it's political, very often. It's political, very often. So those kids, those 40,000 kids that are dying of starvation are not dying because God has not answered the prayer. They're dying because you and I have not figured out how to get the resources to them, the food to the hungry mouths. Well, what about this? Then sometimes people say, well, what I call the involuntary poverty. The people who are caught in the trap of poverty, people will say, well, that's their own fault. You know, they haven't worked hard enough, or young girls have babies. It's their fault. Well, I read this parable, and whose fault was it that this younger son was feeding the pigs? Whose fault was it? Was it his dad's fault? It was his fault. But did that change the way the father looked at him? Did the father say, well, that dumb kid went out and squandered his resources? I don't want any more to do with him. Sometimes as parents, we felt that way about our kids. You know, they've made their own bed, so let them lie in it. You ever feel that way sometimes? I've got some feelings like that about my kids from time to time. But can you picture this father? I picture this father sitting on the front porch of his house, maybe every day, waiting for that young boy to come back. Maybe you've had a son or daughter who's gone on his or her own pilgrimage for a long time. I have a son who's like that, hadn't heard from him for a whole year, and you just keep wishing. Then in the middle of the night, 3 o'clock in the night, middle of the night, when he's soused on beer, he calls old pops, you know, collect. Well, do you accept a collect call from your kid you haven't heard from for months? In the middle of the night? Of course you do. And that gets to be a pattern after a while, and I finally say, now look, I'm not going to pay for these phone calls anymore. So then I don't hear from him again for several months. But from that point on, he pays for his own phone calls. Believe it or not, he did. prodigal son. The father keeps waiting and waiting and waiting. There's a wonderful book called The Waiting Father. And it reminds me of the Catholic priests who decided that the church in Central America, I mentioned this the other day, should show preferential option for the poor. The father did not love the younger son more than the older son, but the younger son needed the father's love more than the older son did at that moment. So you give special attention to the needy one. Preferential option for the poor. So that they too can join in the joy of those who stayed at home. And the big question is whether the elder son can be as accepting of his brother as the father was of his son. And that speaks directly to the religious people in Jesus' day. Those Pharisees who were grumbling. They're the older son. How come you can't see that God loves these people? How come you can't see that? Jesus is very, very sad, very disappointed in the religious people of his day. I wonder how he looks at the religious people of our day. I hardly dare think about that because I'm one of them. Then the parable of the unjust steward. This has got to be the most puzzling parable of all. Do you remember that? Chapter 16, 19 through 31? No context for this one. Just have Jesus talking. Tells this puzzling story about a rich man who heard that his manager, as the text we have calls him, was squandering, so he fires him, he threatens to fire him. The manager decides to protect himself. He says, I'm not strong enough to dig and I'm ashamed to beg. I like that. I think that's what I don't want to do any hard labor and I don't want to have to go out and beg. So he goes to all his master's debtors and reduces their debts and ingratiates himself to them on the theory that now from in the future if he gets fired, well, he can go to them and get a little help in return. And surprisingly, his boss commends him for this behavior and praises him for his shrewdness. That really sounds like a crazy thing. Why did Jesus say that kind of manipulation is to be commended? Well, people tried to figure this one out. One writer I picked up says that the way to understand this is that the manager was lending money, or lent money owned by the rich man. That was his job. He was supposed to handle the finances of the rich man. And he also set the rate of interest that the debtors were to pay, which was often very high. So what he was doing in this parable was forgiving the interest. And the interest, a portion of which would have gone to the manager. So what he was really doing was sacrificing his own income rather than only his master's income. Now, most writers feel like that's stretching the story a little bit. One of the delightful ways of looking at this parable comes from Elton Trueblood. Do any of you remember that name? Elton Trueblood wrote a book called The Humor of Christ. He says that Elton Trueblood was a Quaker. He taught at Earlham College in Indiana. When I was a student, Kermit and I are about the same age. His books were very, very popular among college students. And I remember we had a conference on campus at Earlham College. And I wanted to see the room where Dr. Trueblood taught. And I was showed this room, and it had a big round table about the size of this. And in the middle of the room and some chairs around it, that's where Trueblood taught his classes. He sat with a few students and conversed. Boy, I wish I could have had that teaching situation when I was teaching college. I'd have 60 students in the room. It was quite good. Well, in this book, he says that the germ of the idea, his own language, of writing this book was one day he was reading, he and his wife were reading to their, I think, 4-year-old son, and they were reading this passage about don't try to take the speck out of your neighbor's eye when you've got a log coming out of your eye. And this little boy started to laugh. And he stopped and thought, well, what's he laughing about? Well, the boy said, well, that's funny. A log coming out of his eye? That's crazy. And Trueblood thought, yeah, that is crazy. That's really funny. Jesus must have said that with a big smile on his face. He must have known how comical that was, ironic, that whole idea was. So Trueblood went back and started reading the Gospels, and he found lots of places where he felt that Jesus was speaking with irony and with humor. And he tells us that particularly in the Gospel of Luke, this is one of the things I think is fun, is that one of the commentators on Trueblood's book says that the Gospel of Matthew is very grim by comparison with the Gospel of Luke. That there are lots of things in Luke where Jesus must have been smiling and laughing when he told the story.
In that book, The Humor of Christ, this one way of putting it, where this farmer carefully strains a bug out of the milk and swallows the cow.
Yeah.
Except it's a camel, which is even
a
more
camel.
Ludicrous.
Right. Swallows the camel. Yeah. I was going to, we don't have time, but take the, where is this? I found a passage that I thought would be fun to read out loud and just ask ourselves if Jesus wasn't smiling when he told those that story. It's in chapter 22. Just turn to that for a minute. Chapter 22. This is one of the passages that Trueblood finds humorous. Chapter 22, verse 25. No. Chapter 7, verse 31 through 35. That's it. Now, we're not suggesting that he was laughing out loud. Just think about the possibility that maybe he was chuckling a little bit as he said this. This is fine. I have to get in the mood. This is not putting Jesus down. I hope you understand. This is not making Jesus into a fool. But it's just his humanity coming through. He's having some fun. And he had a right to have some fun, for goodness sakes. We have fun. To what then will I compare the people of this generation? And what are they like? Oh, they're like children sitting in the marketplace. And they're calling one another. We played the flute for you, and you didn't dance. And we wailed, and you didn't weep. But John the Baptist has come, eating no bread and drinking no wine, and you say he's a demon. You call him a demon. He's got a demon because he doesn't eat and drink. The Son of Man comes eating and drinking, and you say, look, a glutton and a drunkard. Hey, you can't win. You can't win his presence. A friend of all people, the tax collectors and the sinners. And then this, nevertheless, wisdom is vindicated by all her children. Well, what in the world is that? Now, that's got to be kind of an ironic statement. Just kind of get in that mood. Well, Trueblood thinks that this parable is an example of Jesus' humor. And that Jesus told this story. Remember, there's no context here. The story's just in there, put in there. Jesus said, blah, blah, blah. So we don't know what the setting was for the story. And Trueblood suggests that the story is so ridiculous that people certainly must have gotten the point. that that is not the way an honorable person would behave. I mean, it's obvious that that's not an honorable way to behave. So maybe that's the answer to this puzzling parable. I don't know. Comments?
Is that the commentary after the story, the sons of this world are wiser in their own generation than the sons of light?
Yeah.
Well, it's amazing how astute people can be in their personal or business life, and yet when it comes to the church, they suddenly act so cautious or afraid.
Right.
And I think that's a powerful message in that parable, is the commentary.
Yeah, it's sort of a
thing. Think what would happen in the church if you would use your creativity and energy and imagination that makes you a millionaire. Think what it would do for the church.
Yeah. Well, that's what some commentators have tried to say, that then you'd have money to give to the church and alms and all.
Well, no, I mean you would have creative ministry. You would have tremendous energy.
Yeah.
Not just the financial, but the whole imagination and creativity.
In that verse 9, you know, isn't he saying, this is how you get into, well, the implication is this is how you get to heaven, by being, you know, tricky.
Dishonest.
Well, or is it the other place? I mean, so that when it's gone, you'll be welcomed into eternal dwellings. I mean,
you don't really see that squaring with the rest of the teaching of Jesus.
No,
it doesn't seem to. That's the problem. Well, we're running out of time, as we always do. Rich man and Lazarus, you know that story? Again, there's no context provided. This rich man, elegantly dressed, eating sumptuously, while outside his house is this poor person. Somebody pointed out that as Jesus tells his story, the rich man doesn't have a name, but the beggar does have a name. And the name is Lazarus, which means God helps. Maybe a little irony there, too. And Lazarus dies and is carried, carried off by the angels to be with Abraham. And the rich man dies and he's in Hades. The contrast between these two people. And the rich man pleads for mercy and wants Lazarus to come and help him. Boy, he's really accustomed to having the poor people serve him, isn't he? He even wants God to tell Lazarus to come and help him. Little irony in that, maybe, too, huh? Not possible, he's told, because the contrast is the chasm. There's still contrast between them, the chasm between them. So then he says, well, then send Lazarus again. You know, order Lazarus around. Make him your servant. Get Lazarus to go down and warn my brothers. And the reply is, they've already been warned. They've got Moses. They've got the law and the prophets. Moses means Torah, law and prophets. And even if someone were to come back from the dead, they will not change. They will not repent. Little irony in that too, maybe, huh? Looking forward to his own resurrection. We don't know for sure. Now, this rich man didn't do anything wrong particularly, apparently, but he lived in the presence of poverty without being disturbed by that and acting toward that. This little book that I cited the other day by Jonathan Kozel tells about how bitter some of these people are toward rich people. As I said, they live in the South Bronx, not more than a couple of miles from the wealthiest neighborhoods in this country on Manhattan Island. And they know the rich people are up there. I've often thought when I was a kid, during the Depression, we were very poor. We didn't have any money. I wore patched overalls to school, and my mother made stuff out of flour sacks. We didn't have any money. We went to town on Saturday night to exchange our eggs for groceries. It was very little money exchange in the 30s. But the difference between then and now is everybody was poor. So we all felt a kind of community in that. The dreadful thing now is that people who live in terrible poverty see wealth all around them. They see it on their television screen. And they see guys who play basketball making millions of dollars because they can put a ball through a hoop, they make millions of dollars. And they see people peddling drugs on the street making thousands of dollars. Well, why should I go to school if I'm a kid in that situation? Why not become a drug dealer? Makes sense. If I were like the unjust steward, that's what I'd do, huh? I'd figure out how to manipulate the situation to my benefit. And there's this, the story here is how wealth becomes destructive when it's lived comfortably in the midst of poverty. I mentioned the other day Jose Miranda, the priest from the theologian from Mexico City, who has books about communism in the Bible, this is one of them, and about Marx, the Marxist vision of the classless society, egalitarian society. And in the lecture he gave in the Twin Cities, I mentioned he was there and I heard him speak, he says, there's nothing, Jesus does not say that there's anything about wrong about wealth per se, but what he talks about is differential wealth. By differential wealth, he means where there's a gap between the rich and the poor. And one of the big and important realities in the United States, economically speaking, is the growing gap between the rich and the poor. It's growing all the time. One of our congresspeople in Minnesota, Martin Olaf Sable, good Norwegian, has a bill in Congress in which he would put a cap on the size of the salary for CEOs in corporations that could be tax deductible. Corporation can pay anything they want to, but they can't deduct as part of their cost of running the corporation a salary higher than 25 times what's paid to the poorest, the lowest salary in that corporation. When you read about, it's a wonderful bill, I think. When you read about CEOs making $15 million, $100 million, who's paying for that?
We are.
We're paying for it in the product we buy, and we're paying for it in our taxes, because that's tax deductible, that salary. It's part of determining the net income of the corporation, isn't it? So I think that's a marvelous idea. And we need to do something about the gap between the rich and the poor in this country. And that's what it seems to me this parable is all about. Now we keep running out of time. We notice how Jesus is always concerned about the outcast. And I have some other things to illustrate that, but let me just say in conclusion, the dramatic example is that person who hung next to Jesus on the cross. What was he? A thief. He was a rascal. He was everything bad. He was being given capital punishment by society for being a bad, bad apple. And Jesus says to him, today you will be with me in paradise. That had to be shocking to the people who witnessed that event on the cross. That's our Savior, who turns society upside down and cares for the poor, the outcasts. God bless us all. Let us find ourselves in the middle of this and live our lives faithfully. Go in peace. Serve the living God.
Thanks be to God.
Amen.